Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a Crowd podcast.
We didn't start the fire. The only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Hemingway,
Eichmann,
Stranger in a Strange Land,
Dylan,
Berlin,
Bay of Pigs Invasion,
Lawrence of Arabia,
British Beatlemania,
Ole Miss.
Oh, we're talking riots, Katie, racial riots.
We're talking bigotry, the same old ugly story. Hello again, and welcome to episode 90 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the history podcast that recklessly adopts Billy Joel's hit song as our marching orders to the biggest headlines, heroes, and villains of the late 20th century. I'm Katie Puckrick.
I'm Tom Fordyce.
Tom, I'm wondering how the heck did we get to where we are today? Billy has a notion that it might have something to do with Ole Miss. Now, this is the University of Mississippi.
Mm.
In 1962, which is at the time that Ole Miss hits in the song, there are race riots over the admission of its first black student, James Meredith. And I'm thinking this is so weird. Like, America had a problem, still has a problem with this, because we've already dealt with this in episode 56, the Little Rock episode.
Yeah.
That was already 3 years after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court ruling, and that was when the nine students attempted to enter Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, but they're stopped by police and locals are freaking out about it. And here we are all these years later, it's still a problem.
A lot of questions, Katie, and a lot of questions to answer. And I'm glad to say we've got a really good guest today. And that's Chuck K. Ross, the Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Mississippi. Chuck, welcome.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me on, Tom and Katie. Looking forward to being able to talk about this very, very historic moment that took place at our university and really changed our overall state.
So this is incredible. You're exactly the right person to talk about this, Chuck, because you know James Meredith personally. You educate at that university. And my first question is, okay, so the Supreme Court ruled on a decision in 1954 to desegregate schools across America. Arkansas was lagging, but they got their act together. Mississippi really dragging its feet. Did this Supreme Court ruling not have any teeth?
Well, the Supreme Court decision that came down in 1954, this Brown decision in May, it stipulated that the Supreme Court and the decision was supposed to be implemented with all deliberate speed. Now, what that means is basically the Supreme Court doesn't have an army. Commander-in-Chief of the United States Armed Forces in this country, which is President of the United States, is going to have that responsibility. And as you talked about, over in Little Rock, those nine African-American students filed legislation, went all the way up through the Supreme Court. And so Dwight D. Eisenhower reluctantly decided to implement this decision. But it had not played itself out in terms of colleges and universities. When you start thinking about schools in the Deep South and when you start thinking about the University of Mississippi and all of its history, James Meredith was extremely conscious about all of the ramifications, what it would mean. He was in the military and in the Air Force for 9 years. And so he understood, he saw what happened in Little Rock. He saw that the federal government had to respond. And so he decided consciously that he was going to take on segregation and white supremacy at its highest level. And the easiest place to start was the University of Mississippi. And so he filed this Supreme Court case, and it had to work its way through the system, federal courts, and then it got to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court basically said that Mississippi had to capitulate. And so then it fell to the President of the United States, who at the time was John F. Kennedy, had to now implement this decision.
Chuck, can you describe to us what the University of Mississippi would have been like at this time if Katie and I were to be walking around the campus?
Wow. Well, from what I've read and the individuals I've talked to, you know, this institution was founded in 1848, really by individuals that owned slaves primarily over in the Delta. They wanted a university that they could send their children to that would not be exposed to these concepts of abolition. And so slavery and segregation have been a part of the DNA of this school from the time it was founded. A number of the students went off to the Civil War and were part of a regiment called the University Grays. They fought at Gettysburg, the most important battle in the Civil War. And so for years, the university was tied to these notions and this glamour of what these individuals did in terms of the Civil War, the Lost Cause. And so a number of people sent their children here to meet their prospective husband or wife. Fraternities and sororities were very, very, very powerful. And it was an opportunity to socialize at a very high level. Class was very, very important in terms of individuals that they wanted to meet and continue to have families and continue to have this kind of aristocracy, this kind of gentry that was a part of the fabric of the founding of this state. And so white supremacy was fundamental. It was crucial. It was a part of DNA. It was a part of the identity of individuals. And so most people looked at and walked around this campus with the idea that it probably is always going to be like this. It's always going to be white. It's always going to have, you know, social things where typically only white students are involved, white professors, white football players, whatever the case may be, white cheerleaders, the whole nine yards. And so if you were to try to come here in 1960, it looked very different than it does today. You walk around campus today, it's an entirely different type of school in terms of the number of people and the diversity of people that you're going to see in terms of where they're coming from, in terms of walks of life.
Yeah, so it sounds like in 1962, it was a finishing school for the children of the elite. And all of those kids certainly felt like they were just going to take their parents' place and stay in the ruling class.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the way this school was really kind of founded, and for a number of decades and generations, it played itself out like that. So this idea that this system that has been in place is now getting ready to be interrupted by one individual required a number of conversations, people to be extremely alarmed. And then it's just the audacity that an African-American would now come into this club that has been this way from the time it was established.
I mean, it's the audacity. He was a kind of a one-man band in terms of being a revolutionary. Give us a sense of who James Meredith is, his background. You did mention that he was in the Air Force. He served for 9 years. But growing up, was there any indication that he was going to be following this path of activism?
Absolutely. He grew up in a very interesting situation. He grew up not far from Oxford in a small town called Kosciuszko, Mississippi. And the more important aspect was that his father had a level of independence that a lot of African Americans didn't necessarily have. A number of African Americans were sharecroppers, tenant farmers. They worked for white people in agricultural, picking cotton. And so they were susceptible to all of the problems that come from working for somebody else. They could take your house, they could fire you, they could kick you off the land, so on and so forth. His father owned his own land, and so they had crops that they raised. They were very kind of insulated as a black family, and I think his father instilled a certain level of kind of pride within the context of what's going on during this time period, that you can achieve whatever you want to achieve. You're not a second-class citizen. There aren't necessarily any limitations in society that you have to conform to. Going into the military also really prepped him for what he was going to do, because he was one of the first individuals, when as the military began to be desegregated after 1948, He was one of the first individuals in the Air Force, and so he was moved around on a number of bases, and invariably he might be the only African-American on that base, only African-American in that regiment. He had to deal with hostility from individuals who had not been around African-Americans. And so when he got out of the Air Force, he understood there's the Constitution, there's the military, and invariably the military can provide a certain level of protection for you if you in fact decide to do that. I think also he got a certain amount of discipline. He understood, you know, fear from a perspective as a soldier. I think all of this played into him. So from his founding, he had a kind of independence. He goes into the military, that gives him another layer. And I think that the whole time after he gets out of the Air Force, he spends 2 years at Jackson State. And the whole time he was at Jackson State, he talked to a number of people about he was going to go and integrate the University of Mississippi. And people invariably said, you know, what do you think about why? In fact, my first cousin was at Jackson State with him. And they had a number of conversations about what he was thinking. And he was absolutely focused that this was something that he needed to do to help to begin to change the way this state has been set up for African Americans.
Wow. So he had a mission. He was a man on a mission.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. He talks about how his father really planted this seed and he bought into it that you actually can do this. You know, this was something that was planned. This wasn't something that he just kind of woke up and decided, hey, you know, I'm gonna decide to go on ahead and go to the University of Mississippi. No, he meticulously, because he wanted to go to the place that he knew was going to provide the most resistance.
It's an extraordinarily brave thing to do, Chuck. I'm interested how the University of Mississippi at this point would stop African-American students from getting in, because would you have to stipulate your background on an admissions form? How subtle and how nasty and how egregious were these ways of stopping African-Americans enrolling?
Well, you have to understand that, you know, it's kind of difficult because we're looking at this from a kind of modern 2022 kind of perspective. But first of all, there's an informal, you know, Emmett Till was lynched in 1955, a 14-year-old boy for just looking at a white woman the wrong way, supposedly whistling at her, getting out of line. And the individuals who were arrested and charged and went to trial basically didn't apologize. In fact, openly, for the most part, admitted that they, in fact, we did this. And it went scot-free. So for African-Americans in this state, you understood that there are certain lines that are in place. There's a certain level of respect that you're supposed to give whites. You're supposed to be very deferential. And to apply to the University of Mississippi, you're in essence saying that you're probably going to open yourself up to some kind of violence. There's going to be some kind of response. There's going to be some kind of backlash.
Yeah.
Are you really willing to do that? Megar Evers, who was the first field secretary of the NAACP in 1953, applied, and they subsequently changed the overall admission requirements. For example, it went from like two individual alumni that you needed to have assign a reference letter for you to like six.
Right.
There was a lot of red tape, you know, that would take place. And Meredith knew that. And importantly, he reached out to Megar Evers, who really was supportive. And then in the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall, who was the first African-American to serve on the Supreme Court, in essence, took the case. He and Meredith didn't necessarily see eye to eye, and so Thurgood Marshall decided to assign the case to his top lawyer, who was Constance Baker Motley. She had a personality that meshed more with Meredith. She kind of rolled with the punches. She was very meticulous, very tough like him, and very driven. She worked the case all the way up from the lower level, all the way up through the Supreme Court. And eventually, even though Mississippi made all of these kind of ludicrous kind of arguments about why Meredith should not be admitted and why segregation was something kind of legal for their state and for this particular university, the U.S. Supreme Court basically stipulated that they had to admit him by September of 1962.
So get a load of this. James Meredith wrote in his application letter to Ole Miss, "Nobody handpicked me. I believed and believe now that I have a divine responsibility. I am familiar with the probable difficulties involved in such a move as I am undertaking, and I am fully prepared to pursue it all the way to a degree from the University of Mississippi." Now, that is a manifesto. I'm wondering, so the order comes down from the Supreme Court that University of Mississippi has to allow him to attend, but it seems that the state's governor, Ross Barnett, made it his mission to keep Mississippi schools from being integrated. I'm wondering, Chuck, what drove the government? Was it just plain old business as usual racism? Were there political considerations?
Oh, it was all of the above. I think that Ross Barnett had run as a kind of good old boy. He was going to represent the mass of white people in this state. And as he articulated on a number of occasions, that as long as he was governor, he was going to make sure that the university remained all white. Of course, one of the interesting aspects of him is that he had all these negotiations, conversations with the Kennedy administration, John, and his brother Robert, who was the attorney general. A lot of those tapes are at the Civil Rights Museum up in Memphis, and they're very interesting in that the Kennedys are going back and forth about we've got a court order. You know, this isn't something that we created. The Supreme Court put this in our lap. We now have to enforce it. We need him to be protected. Can you guarantee us that he's going to be protected? Barnett goes back and forth and really, you know, never commits to being able or willing to protect Meredith, because he's looking at this from the perspective that he wants to get reelected. And he has no natural love for African Americans. And so he's trying to save face, and he's trying to keep the university all white with the hope that maybe Meredith may, in fact, give up. And he underestimates the tenacity of James Meredith. Ross Barnett, on the 29th of September, the University of Mississippi is playing Kentucky down in Jackson. He goes and he demands that he wants to speak to the crowd at halftime. And in essence, he basically articulates that, you know, I love Mississippi. I love and respect our heritage and customs, and I love our people. It's almost as though he's saying, I love all the white people in Mississippi. I mean, people go crazy. And he, in essence, almost tries to make this public pledge that he's going to keep the university from being integrated. And that really gets people fired up. And when they come back and they see marshals surrounding the Lyceum, they feel like the federal government has snuck Meredith in while they were down at this football game, that Ross was telling us that he was going to make sure that this wasn't going to happen, and he's our leader. But yet the federal government is invading us again, like they invaded us during the Civil War. So that almost facilitates a certain amount of real animosity from the beginning. When students begin to come back to campus, ride back on the train, and they see the federal marshals have surrounded the Lyceum, they are just really upset that while we were down at the football game having a good time and our leader was telling us and pledging that this wasn't going to happen, John F. Kennedy and them are now have decided to sneak him in, and what are we going to kind of do about it? So that kind of creates this framework of what happens with this riot on that Sunday night.
Chuck, it seems to escalate extraordinarily quickly. It's within an hour or so that the rioting begins and thousands of people turn up on campus.
Yes, there's some circumstances that, you know, as these students begin to come back, they see the marshals, this general who led the federal troops in aiding the 9 African Americans to integrate Central Arkansas. He comes to Oxford and he, in essence, holds court in the middle of campus, basically tells people, what are you going to do about this? This is your state. This is your school. He also articulates that what I did in Little Rock was wrong. That was the wrong thing to do. I should not have helped the federal government to integrate that
And this is General Edwin Walker.
This is General Edwin Walker, exactly. And so he's at the monument and he's getting people whipped up. The other factor is that we were in a process of building our biology building called Shoemaker, and there were just numerous pallets of bricks that have been set out.
Right.
And this really almost takes on a kind of final battle of the Civil War for a number of people. For a number of people here in the South, and particularly in Mississippi, the whole idea that the South lost the Civil War is hard, is been something that's very, very difficult to stomach, because when you go to the square, which is where our town center is located, there's another monument on the square. And we have 82 counties in this state. And I would guarantee that the vast majority of them at the courthouse, you have these monuments to these Confederate soldiers. And throughout the South, probably Alabama, South Carolina, Georgia, these small towns. And the idea is that these young men exhibited a certain amount of courage, that they didn't lose the war because they couldn't fight or they didn't exhibit the kind of tenacity, that there were some other variables that were involved, that they don't even deal with the whole concept that African Americans were liberated and got into the war and helped them maybe change it by 185,000 African Americans fighting. But they deal with it is that this was a noble cause. And so people began to just trickle in here with that same kind of mindset. I mean, there's an interesting story as things began to just really deteriorate and it begins to become more and more violent. And these marshals are holding on, trying to use tear gas. Paul Johnson, who's a lieutenant governor, comes to Oxford, and there's an old gentleman that shows up with a Civil War musket from his grandfather, great-grandfather. Oh. And he tells the lieutenant governor, "Where do you want me to go?" I mean, and that in a lot of ways just epitomizes what this was all about, that a lot of the riot and a lot of the participation was that, you know, hey, these Yankees are getting ready to invade us and they're using this African American and we're just not going to stand for it. There's a call to arms. We've got to respond. This is our school. This is our state. And so it becomes very, very intense in terms of the violence, the shooting, and all of the things that take place that night. And those marshals were extremely lucky to really hold on until the federal authorities, until the military comes out of Memphis and arrives, almost kind of like helping them to survive the rest of the night.
And where is James Meredith in the middle of this melee?
James Meredith is in Baxter Hall. He's on campus. He's surrounded by federal marshals. And again, this really epitomizes, you know, the way he doesn't acknowledge kind of fear publicly. You ask him, what was he doing that night? And he said he didn't hear anything. He was fast asleep.
Right. So what a cool character.
No one's asleep in Oxford that night.
And there were fatalities, though, weren't there?
Yes, there was a bystander from Oxford that was killed, shot and killed, and then a reporter, Guillard, a French reporter, that was also shot and killed. We have never brought charges against anyone. A couple of marshals were wounded. Many people didn't think they were going to survive during the night, and they were able to kind of patch them up. The Lyceum turned into almost a kind of breakout headquarters for these marshals, and they had run out of tear gas, and they were very close to being overrun when the 4th and 3rd unit comes out of Memphis and arrives and begins to restore order back here on campus and throughout the city of Oxford as well.
Well, Chuck, it sounds like this is like a little leftover last gasp, final battle of the Civil War, the way you're portraying it.
Yes, it's an excellent book that has been written by a journalist called The Battle of Oxford. And it's a meticulous blow-by-blow look at what happened in terms of how the riot starts and what happens throughout the night and the fallout. And in essence, it's an argument that this, in fact, really does represent this last kind of battle of the Civil War. That when you think about, you know, a number of things that had taken place in terms of federal legislation, Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown decision and Little Rock and a number of people losing their lives, getting out of place as African Americans, and this whole real commitment to white supremacy that really evolves once the Civil War ends. This was the last kind of stand where you have this level of overtness. The more positive thing is that in many ways, this helps to, without a doubt, fundamentally change the state of Mississippi and the University of Mississippi. I make an argument that the University of Mississippi actually begins to be founded as a real live university and institution, one that is open to all people on October the 1st of 1962. When you look at the state of Mississippi and you look at the number of individuals that are now in the legislature that have now become mayors, and here I sit talking to two individuals in London at the University of Mississippi as a faculty member, and I'm the acting chair of the history department. And so all of these things, I wouldn't be able to sit here, all of these things that have taken place because of the courage and the tenacity and the audacity of James Meredith thinking that this is possible, that I'm going to make sure that this can happen. This can, and somebody's got to make a stand. And in fact, it's very difficult to really thank him and articulate what he did. You really just have to look at where Mississippi was and where we are now. And it's very clear that his gesture is very, very, very difficult to measure up to.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online. I've got a question for you. How is your social battery feeling right now? Because it can be easy to ignore how we're feeling and sometimes spread ourselves too thin. You know what it's like. Social gatherings are starting to pick up pace after the long drag of winter. But what's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Well, therapy can help give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. So if you're thinking of exploring these areas and starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/WDSTF, for We Didn't Start the Fire. That's betterhelp.com/WDSTF. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Always fresh and never frozen, each meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. I eat flexitarian, so with a weekly menu of 35 options, there's plenty for me to choose from. So last night, I had the Moroccan-style almond-crusted salmon. It was absolutely delicious. These are no fuss, no mess meals. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savour the good stuff. With over 60 add-ons like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and smoothies, there's plenty of options to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. Plus, you can customise your weekly meals and pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/WDSTF50 and use the code WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code WDSTF50 at factormeals.com/WDSTF50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Just going back to the night itself and that dramatic escalation, Chuck, was the Kennedy administration taken by surprise? Were there some misjudgments on behalf of JFK and his brother Robert?
I don't think there were any misjudgments. I think the Kennedys knew exactly what they were working with. The Kennedys had a clear experience with the South. The Freedom Riders started off in 1961, and John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert were politicians. They were in a changing Democratic Party. They were in a party in which Southerners were leaving. And so they were trying to, in essence, keep the voting South to continue to support and identify with the Democratic Party nationally. And in 1961, when CORE and individuals from SNCC decided that they were going to initiate these freedom rides and they left out of Washington, D.C., Robert Kennedy was really livid about, why are you guys going and challenging segregation? Why don't you just work on voter registration? Because he was, in essence, saying, you're getting ready to now put us in a box. Because when you go down on these buses and you go into the South, and now you're going to have a violent reaction by individuals, either in law enforcement or local people, you're going to put now the federal government in a box to have to come and protect you. We don't need this headache. And so they were clear about what Southerners would do when pushed. And so this idea that, you know, they weren't totally sure that, you know, maybe they could believe that Ross Barnett was going to fulfill his responsibilities as governor and make sure that the Mississippi Highway Patrol stayed in place and making sure that Meredith was brought in without any kind of violence. If anything, they knew just the opposite was going to happen. They made a political decision because John F. Kennedy wanted, again, to look as though he was being very reactionary, that he was not the aggressor. And so he was not going to deploy the military when he should have deployed the military. And things would have been very, 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 very different in terms of the way in which they played themselves out in terms of violence. That if you had the army in place, people would have been very upset. People in the Democratic Party and the leadership may have continued to leave in droves. And that would have made it very, very, very difficult for them to potentially get reelected again in 1964.
It's a staggering number of troops that is deployed in the end. It's 30,000 in total, isn't it? Which is the largest ever single disturbance in US history. And yet Meredith manages to enroll the very next day on the 1st of October.
Yes, he manages to enroll the next day. In fact, the marshals drive him down the hill from Baxter to the Lyceum. He comes into the Lyceum and the registrar is there to wait for him, and they enroll him, they give him a schedule. And then they proceed to walk him across campus from the Lyceum, short distance, to Bondurant, where his first class takes place. And he goes upstairs and he sits in a classroom. And of all things, his first class that he takes at the University of Mississippi with all of this backdrop is American history. And he does an excellent job. I think the other thing that has been forgotten is that he graduates from the university in the summer of 1963. And so it's one thing to cause this big uproar, all of this people, you know, articulating that African-Americans don't have the intellectual wherewithal to be successful as students here, not even taking under consideration the death threats that he had to withstand. And every day that you get up and you walk to Bondurant or Peabody or whatever building you have to go in, nobody wants to sit next to you. Nobody wants to talk to you. Go in and try to eat. Nobody sits next to you. You got marshals accompanying you. Every day you get up, you have to think about, is this the day somebody runs up to you? Are these marshals going to protect you? Does somebody try to kill you? But you still got to do your homework. You got to turn in papers. You got to take exams. You're a student. He finishes the mission.
He must have had such a sense of how significant he was and the fact that he was able to stay the course through being harassed through his semesters at Ole Miss. How was he as a man able to stand up to this constant psychological torment?
he has this ability, from my perspective, to be somewhere physically, but not be in that same location mentally, emotionally, or psychologically. So he was able to not give any indication that I'm worried. Even in interviews, he was very protective of his honesty. He doesn't say, oh, you know, I'm worried and I don't know if these marshals are going to protect me or if some crazy white person is going to come up to me. And so that has been a survival mechanism that he's utilized. And I think that he didn't turn that off, I think, right away when he left the university and he was involved in a number of kind of conservative kind of pursuits and connections with conservative individuals. He got involved in his March Against Fear in 1966. But when you ask him questions, I think reporters can get very frustrated with him because he is going to protect his honesty. He's going to protect all the frailties that make him an actual human being. I'm not going to give that to you. I've got to protect this so that I can continue to move forward and move throughout the world.
It's such a remarkable legacy that he has, Chuck. Do you see that he's mellowed at all as he's got older? Because he's in his very late 80s now. And as he looks back on his life and must be able to see around him in the fabric of his nation, the changes that he helped to bring about, has he changed at all?
He has changed. When we dedicated, we have a monument on our campus to him. When the university dedicated it, like 2012, we had a football game and he came and tailgated. And that was one of the first times I saw him open himself up from the perspective that he sat in the area in the Grove and a number of African-American students came up and they wanted to thank him and he interacted. He didn't say anything about not being a role model or throw them off. He took a bunch of pictures. Even during that time period that we were there tailgating, he actually pulled me to the side and said, do you think they're really going to do this? They're really going to dedicate the monument? I said, yeah, man, they're going to dedicate the monument. So that was the one time I saw him give me a certain level of kind of human honesty. I think that he's kind of felt that, hey, number one, I've lived a long time. 89 is a long time and to still have your faculties. And then you look around and, you know, your son received a PhD from the university. You've got a granddaughter now that has graduated. You know, there's some real things that you've seen that have taken place. And so maybe it's time for you to accept those kind of accolades.
This is something I was reading up on James Meredith and a couple of things that he got up to in the 60s after he graduated caught my eye. He continued with his activism and talk about strange political bedfellows. James Meredith was a supporter of the unsuccessful 1967 gubernatorial bid of his arch nemesis, Ross Barnett, which is completely bizarre to me. And also, he supported the 1991 gubernatorial campaign of ex-Ku Klux Klansman David Duke. And he also worked for the avowed segregationist Jesse Helms in the early 1990s. Do you have any insights as to why he would be working with or supporting these kind of people?
Well, that's a phase of his life that individuals like myself really struggle with, because this idea that you're going to try to help Ross Barnett get reelected because you're really trying to help him in a certain sense. You're going to extend a certain level of forgiveness. Helms was the one individual that responded in Congress when you were trying to get some kind of grant or whatever the deal was. And I'm not sure what the David Duke connection. I think that in a certain sense, he looks at these kind of neoconservative individuals as individuals who are given a message that African Americans have got to not necessarily rely on the government. You got to do these things on your own. He's always seen himself as a lone soldier. He's always tried to publicly articulate that he didn't see himself as a part of the civil rights movement. I take issue with that. If he was here, I would articulate, hey, wait a minute. you were a lone person and you were this lone soldier, yes, okay, we get that. But in order to get this done, you had to run to Megar Evers. And Megar Evers reached out to Thurgood Marshall and others. You didn't have the money to get this done. And so you needed the civil rights organizations and individuals that were committed to fundamental change in this state, in this country, to get this done. So you can't distance yourself. So you can't have it both ways.
Exactly. And the other thing is, in order to accomplish what he accomplished, which was huge, and to have the right stuff and to have the metal to tough it out, you have to be ornery. You have to be contrary. So it seems like the attributes that enabled him to succeed make him also a little bit prickly, and maybe he's not playing ball with the rest of the team.
Right. It's very difficult now, you know, so all of a sudden, you know, you're thinking outside the box. You come up with this on your own. Nobody else is willing to do this. But yet you're going to now lead me, Dr. King, or some other kind of civil rights leader. No. I'm not going to let you do that. And so I think that's been the other aspect of him, is that's made it very difficult for him to really kind of be accepted in a certain sense in terms of the whole African-American community. Because on the one hand, when you start making those kind of statements that you're not really a part of the civil rights movement for African Americans, that's a head scratcher, because it's, you know, it's a situation where if you're an African American, almost you don't have much of a choice, because the civil rights movement is something that has been fundamental in trying to make your life better. And to say that you don't want to necessarily be connected to it. Black people in this country, it's very difficult for you to just be totally individualistic. You're always going to kind of, regardless of, you know, how much money or what kind of prestige, whether you're the president of the United States, Barack Obama, when you're driving your car in Montana, you're an African-American when the police pull you over. You're right. Michael Jordan, and you sitting up here and you own the Charlotte Bobcats, and you have posters in all kind of people's bedrooms in the suburbs all across the country. When you're driving through Montana and they pull you over, you're a black man behind the wheel of a car. And if it's a white police officer, there are going to be a lot of things that's going to go through your mind, just like they're going to go through my mind when they pull you over. And so there is that component that makes it kind of difficult for you to kind of accept some of the positions that he's taken.
Well, it sounds like from what you've said that James Meredith has gotten his head right about this, and he has finally taken on the mantle of being a civil rights trailblazer. And in fact, he deserves that mantle.
Yes, he does. You know, on the one hand, I think that, you know, he's not going to just relax, but he also likes people to acknowledge what he achieved, because he understands deep down inside that very, very few human beings on this earth could have achieved what he was able to achieve.
Casey, we're really lucky on this podcast. We get to talk to some fascinating people and hear their stories and their perspectives. But Chuck, I have to say, today has been a really special episode for us, for your expertise, your insight, and your personal dealings with the extraordinary man who is James Meredith. I'd like to say thank you very much.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.
Some of those insights, Katie, I was just sitting and listening spellbound.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is the fact that James Meredith is a reluctant hero and how it frustrates his disciples, his fans, like, you know, come on, just admit.
Of course,
that, yeah. You saved our bacons. You made it possible for us to have an education and to do as much as we wanted to with our lives. And he's sort of not playing the game. I have to admit that I have a begrudging respect for that sort of contrariness.
Yeah, and we often do this, Katie, don't we? When we hear about these people who have changed the course of history, I don't know if you do this, but I try and imagine how I would react in that situation. I wouldn't have anywhere near the gumption, the bravery, and the, as you said, the orneriness of James Meredith to do what he did.
He did a kind of that technique that Chuck was talking about. It sounded a little bit like disassociation, where he just does this Zen thing of taking himself out of the moment, just focusing on getting through this Herculean task that he set for himself.
Yeah, absolutely. If you would like another podcast to listen to before Katie and I return, make sure you check out Eliza, A Robot Story. Now, this is a dark near future science fiction podcast about a robot who can feel and the world that attempts to control her.
When Eliza falls in love with the man who controls her, they work together to make her fully sentient. But consciousness doesn't come without consequences.
As Eliza gets caught in a web of both loving and abusive relationships, she has to fight to survive. It's fiction, or is it? Just search for Eliza, A Robot Story, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, robots, and if you have any guest ideas or just something you'd like to get off your chest, share with us. You can contact us on email at fire@crowdnetwork.co.uk or on social media. We're at Spread That Fire on Instagram and Twitter.
Next week, Katie, we are going to infinity and beyond.
Is that somewhere in the outskirts of Manchester?
We're going to talk about John Glenn.
John Glenn! He went a little bit further than Manchester, didn't he?
He did.
Crowd Network.
A place where you belong.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each 3-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II. And people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.